Thank you, Judy, and thank you all. I'd like to say welcome to all of you and to our international audience. This is a teleclass broadcast. What that means is that we're broadcasting Elaine's lecture to an audience of hundreds of people in the UK and in Europe and Africa, to an audience of thousands of people this afternoon when it's rebroadcast in New York. And when it hits the internet as an online recording, it'll be accessed by tens of thousands of people. I would like to introduce three people who I can't see in the audience, but I'm sure are here: Lauren Tu, Maria Banalek, and Debbie King. These three lovely ladies make the British teleclass series happen. They organize it, they host it, they take all the responsibility for it, and they do a stellar job. Thank you very much, ladies. But my job today is to introduce Dr. Elaine Larson. Elaine is, well, she's no stranger to the teleclass audience. She's given a teleclass each year. As a matter of fact, she's given the first teleclass of the year each year for the past five or six, I think. She is a professor at Columbia University. She's the editor of the American Journal of Infection Control. She's a consultant to the World Health Organization, the CDC, Health Canada, and too many organizations to list. She is a noted expert on hand hygiene, and she is a wonderful person. Her lecture this morning is entitled, Infection Prevention, Challenging Behavior, Changing the Culture. Please help me welcome Dr. Elaine Larson.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I hope that those of you who aren't from Brighton know a little bit more about Brighton than the person that checked us into our hotel. My husband said to her, what is the body of water? Is the English Channel or the Atlantic Ocean? And she said, well, I'm not sure, but if you keep going straight out, you're going to get to Africa. So welcome to the island just north of Africa. I want to just acknowledge the people that you see whose names are here, who allowed me to plagiarize with permission a number of their slides. And we'll be going through things fairly quickly to keep us on time. The goals for this presentation are to identify personal, environmental, and technological factors that influence one's ability to change. This is a time of change, as Judy just said, to explore challenging behavior, potential reasons for inadequate adherence to practice guidelines, and to discuss potentially successful strategies for infection prevention professionals. So first, the life cycle of our profession. In the 50s and 60s was the formative stage. The profession emerged. It responded primarily. It emerged because of responses to outbreaks, and the emphasis was on control of outbreaks and pandemics around the world. Then came the next normative stage, which was the time until about 2000, when we refined the ways that we measured things. We understood a little bit more about what risks were predictive of infection, and we began to use data to develop interventions. And now we're into the integrative stage, a more systems-based approach, not as much of an individual approach, and the idea of targeting zero infections. Even though we've been saying for years that all infections are not preventable, and I'm sure they're not, has to do with host factors still, to have a target of zero tolerance is really the sort of next stage in our development. But the current reality is often that professionals are more isolated than integrated. There are no dedicated learning systems. There's a lack of authority sometimes with infection prevention professionals to implement change. There's a poor understanding of the economics of healthcare-associated infection, disbelief that zero can be achieved or even should be a goal. The infection control professional is more of a cop than a coach. And staff see infection prevention measures as a distraction or an interruption rather than as an integral part of their job. So what factors affect one's ability to change? I'm going to cover three kinds of factors, four kinds really. First of all, personal capabilities and limitations. Secondly, things that have to do with the environment and tasks, our skills, our knowledge, the pace of work. And then thirdly, technology and tools. So let's talk about those factors. And let's start with personal and cultural factors which affect behavior change. I want to talk about generational differences, personal beliefs, and the need to please others or comply with rules and expectations. First of all, I want to talk about cultural and generational differences. And there has been much work done, particularly in anthropology, about this, showing that conformers and nonconformers often know the same facts. They understand the message. But what differs is the meaning that they attach to those facts. So that the problem for most of us in terms of infection prevention is not knowledge or education. It has something to do with perceptions and motivation. So let's talk about generational impacts. You've all heard these terms, baby boomers, for example. Now, baby boomers were born around from 1945 to 64. Some of us in this room are baby boomers. Most of us, I'm afraid, aren't. You're younger. But anyway, these people are currently between the ages of 43 and 60. It's greater than one-fourth of the population. And this group was influenced by World War I, by the beginning of television, the beginning of contraception. Ed Sullivan, the Beatles, spaceflight all occurred during the baby boomers' time. The Gen Xers were born between 1965 and 1980. Now they're about 25 to 42 years old, represents about 14% of the population. They're the first latchkey kids, the ones who came home whose parents were both working. And they were influenced by civil rights, by the hippies, by the Vietnam War, and by the music of that generation. Now we have the millennial group, the Generation Ys, were born between 1981 and the present, aged up to 26. They are three times the size of the Generation X. This is the digital era, computers, video games, cell phones, iPods, cable TV, teens with machines. 90% of this generation uses the internet, and they are immersed in their own universe. And you see people walking around with iPods in their ears, etc. Some of us do. So the generational themes. The baby boomers need to be nice. They need to be well-liked. Obviously, these are stereotypes, but it's kind of fun. They need to be cooperative. They are used to large, crowded, competitive generation. They were born after everybody came back from the war. They care what other people think about them. They want to be part of a team, and recognition is important to them. The Gen Xers don't particularly like to participate, to attend meetings or hear other people's opinions. Just tell me what you want me to do and I'll do it. Recognition is less important. They value technology, speed, continuous change, and they're more individualistic. The millennials, the Gen Yers, are the digital generation. Texting, emailing, instant messages. Let's get our information quick and efficient. The attitudes, the boomers, tell me what I need to know. The Gen X, show me how to do it. The Gen Y, why do I need to do this? The challenges for behavior change is that most teachers are boomers and most learners are Gen Xers. So we've got to develop and adapt our educational approaches to speak to different generations. And I think we don't even sometimes appreciate the fact that we are quite different. So, all right, that's sort of the generational or cultural milieu, if you will. Now let's talk about personal beliefs. This was a survey done, published in the Journal of American Medical Association almost a decade ago. They surveyed over 5,000 publications and found 75 articles of 120 surveys to look at what are barriers for physicians to follow practice guidelines. They investigated 293 potential barriers, and what they found are primarily five kinds of barriers. And I think these relate not just to physicians, but to anybody who is now trying to adopt and practice guidelines. Lack of awareness, lack of agreement, I don't believe what they say, lack of self-efficacy, I'm not sure I am capable of changing, I'm not sure that I'm able to, lack of outcome expectancy, if I change, nothing's going to happen anyway, it doesn't matter. Or inertia, the way I do it is just fine, I'm comfortable with it, I'll keep doing it that way. So they concluded that few intervention studies actually consider the diversity of barriers that we need to address if we're going to effect change. Hence, important interventions that we might use are missed. Now, this was an interesting series of experiments that were published last year in Science magazine called the Macbeth Effect, and it talks about clean hands and morality. And I just thought these were intriguing. I'm not sure exactly what they mean, but it's kind of fun. They took 60 people, and in the first experiment, they asked some people to recall an unethical event and others to recall ethical behavior that they had done. And those that were asked to recall an unethical behavior were 1.5 times more likely to select cleansing-related words. They were given a series of words. They were more likely, for example, to select wash, shower, or soap versus wish, shaker, or step. In the second experiment, those who recalled unethical versus ethical behavior were twice as likely to select a gift of an antiseptic hand wipe rather than a pencil. And in the third experiment, after describing an unethical deed from their past, participants either cleansed their hands or not. Ironically, those who cleansed their hands were half as likely to volunteer to help someone else, and the researchers actually felt that cleansing their hands restored their sense of moral self, so they didn't have to help anybody else. So that was sort of an interesting, intriguing bit. You probably are aware of Dr. Whitby's work. She talks about what drives hand hygiene, and she talks about the emotional concepts of dirtiness and cleanliness. And hand hygiene behavior, she says, may be inherent. When you touch something dirty, when you touch feces, whatever, you automatically realize that you're supposed to do hand hygiene, or elective, that is, following guidelines. And she proposes, she and her colleagues, that elective hand hygiene, such as following guidelines, and this has to do with any guideline, whether it's related to care of catheter lines or whatever, is not instinctively triggered. So although we think that people should know, healthcare professionals should know what they need to do to practice infection prevention, it's a learned behavior. It's not necessarily inherent. And what she concludes is that hand hygiene practices of healthcare workers are learned behaviors from childhood, which are continued in a professional context and reinforced in everyone's daily lives. We strongly caution against unrealistic expectations that are entrenched, long-standing behavior patterns will be changed in a sustaining way solely by the introduction of a new product or a new guideline. Much more complicated than we realize. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about the need to please others or to comply with rules and expectations as something else that is a motivator for change. This is an old study, but I think it still holds true. This was an observational study of hand washing in a public bathroom, a woman's bathroom, and 90% of people who were observed, who knew that they were being observed, washed their hands, and only 3 out of 19, very small sample size, 16% washed their hands when they did not know they were being observed, when nobody else was in the bathroom. So much of our behavior may be related to role modeling and to expectations that we think that our peers and other people have for us. This is a study that we actually did some years ago. The first two lines are, let's see, the first, the sort of purplish is before washing, and the blue is after hand washing. This was a community study of hundreds of people that we did, where we randomly assigned them to either use an antibacterial or a regular soap. And what I want to show you is the first two columns are time one, that is baseline, before we started the study. The second two columns are at the end of the study. And the project was comparing antibacterial soap versus regular soap. The main point I want to show is from the first time, which is the time one, the first column, to time after a year, which is the second column, what you see is this is time one, and this is at the end of a year of the study. And this is with the antimicrobial soap. This is the plain soap at time one and after a year. This is pre-hand wash, post-hand wash. Okay, the point I want to make is there's no significant difference either at time one or after a year between the antimicrobial and the plain soap. It didn't make any difference. But after a year, those who were randomly assigned to use the antibacterial soap or the plain soap both had significant reductions in the counts on their hands pre- and post-wash. Now, why is this? It had nothing to do with the soap. It had to do with the fact that they were in a study. They knew they were in a study. We came to their house once a month to culture their hands. They knew we were going to culture their hands. And from here, this count, microbial count, to here, is simply a change in behavior called the Hawthorne effect, because you know you're being studied. So everybody had reductions in their counts. So there is a very important, when people know they're being watched or when there are expectations for them, their behavior and their microbial flora will improve. So this was another study of a role model in which healthcare workers in a room were with a senior, higher-ranking medical staff person or a peer who did not wash their hands. They were significantly less likely to wash their hands than when the senior person did. Again, just an example of wanting to please. Now, let's move from the personal behavioral factors to change to what are the environmental, organizational, and technological factors affecting behavior change. This is a study that we did in a neonatal intensive care unit observing a little under 15 observations of hand hygiene and gloving practices. And the main thing I want to say here is that we were looking at the impact of the alcohol hand rinse versus 4% chlorhexidine hand washing product. And for those who were randomly assigned to the regular hand washing product, they were twice as likely to touch the baby, the neonate, without hand hygiene before touching, as were the alcohol group. The point here is that the alcohol, of course, was a technology that made it easier for people to clean their hands, so they were twice as likely as the ones who had to go to a sink and wash their hands. This is a study by Bischoff, and basically what it shows is the first two bars, the lighter blue is before patient contact, the darker blue is after patient contact. You can see that at baseline, let's just look at after patient contact, the darker blue, about 20% of staff wash their hands after touching a patient at baseline. With education and feedback, it soared up to about 25%. With an alcohol hand product in a ratio of one dispenser per four beds, it increased. And then when they did put the alcohol at each patient bedside, it increased significantly more. So again, technology, a simple application of alcohol hand products compared to soap and water. We did a study in Washington, D.C. with five elementary schools. And what we did in this intervention was we trained the fourth grade students to teach the first grade students about hand hygiene. We didn't do it, we trained the fourth graders. So then the fourth graders went to the first grade class and did the training, did little, you know, games and so forth about hand washing. And we had four groups, four intervention groups. One was the peer education group, which I just described. A second was the hand wipe and poster group. We put in the bathrooms alcohol hand wipes and posters with no other intervention. The third group had both the peer education and the hand wipes, and then the fourth was a control group that had neither, just regular. And then what we did was we got permission from the schools with great difficulty, it took us a year, to actually stand in the bathrooms and watch whether the children washed their hands or not, which was, you know, they were worried about all kinds of obvious things. So the results were that there was a significant increase pre to post in all intervention groups except the control group. But the change was sustained over 2 months only in the group that had both the peer intervention and the wipes. So what we thought and what we learned is that it takes both. It takes some technology, it takes availability of products, but it also takes the peer expectations. And that's what sustained the change for that school year in those schools. Now, I just wanted to point out one fact that I think is really important, and that is that infection prevention, as I mentioned before, is perceived by staff often as an interruption to what their real task is rather than being part of its task. Here is a quote from the Wall Street Journal. And this is a description written by a nurse, a night nurse. And I think it was what he said was, most nights, unexpected contingencies unwound the tight choreography of the shift, diagrammed in hourly increments in the sprawling spreadsheets of patients' charts. I lurched from one task to the next, fulfilling all requirements but little more. For a while, the electronic thermometers we used were in short supply, and the shift started with a mad dash to nab one. We made a joke of it. Behind the laughs, I heard the clock ticking. Infection control slows down movement. Hands must be washed before and after every contact with a patient, and fresh gown and gloves donned every time one enters a patient room to be discarded when exiting. A thermometer or any other piece of equipment moved to one room or another must be cleaned too. You see, the attitude is it slows us down from our real job, rather than our real job is preventing infections. So we need to understand the system in which we work. In infection prevention and control, we're trained to break down into parts. But in complex systems, relationships between the parts are far greater than the parts alone. An example of a termite hill, I don't know if any of you have seen any of these, but there's no CEO, no chief executive officer termite, no chief nurse termite, etc., just termites that all know their place and tasks in the system. We, on the other hand, establish order and control through actions of a few top people in our organizations. This may be one of the biggest factors holding back innovation and progress in our organizations. Infection control is a complex adaptive system and a socio-technical system. Every organization has social and technical components to it. And Bandura says, as part of her theory, or maybe it's a he, I can't remember, changes in one aspect cause changes in the other after varying time delays, which cause changes in the first, etc. Any simple change will reverberate through the system in planned and unplanned ways. That means that the technical issues that we face are, in fact, also interpersonal and social. For example, someone comes into the emergency room. They can't go to the operating room because the operating suite is busy. After the operating room, they can't go to the recovery room because the recovery room is full. They can't go to the ICU because it's full. They can't go to the ward because they're too sick or there's a wait. They can't go home because the relatives aren't there and there's no ride. What is the status of interventions then to change behavior? This was another review of the literature that we did, and we reviewed several thousand studies, and we found 49 that were intervention studies designed to try to change infection prevention practices. What we found were educational interventions, guidelines, feedback, audits, appropriate process, standing orders, gatekeeping. And in the literature, 76% of those studies reported that there was desired behavior change. However, nobody looked over time to see if they were sustained. And none of them used behavior change models or applied rigorous evaluation over a longer period of time. So I think we need to take a more conceptual approach in the way we try to educate and move toward behavior change. At the individual level, for example, this is a health education model that we use quite a bit when we're particularly, right now, for example, we're using it in a communication study in which we're trying to change the behavior of new immigrants in terms of their antibiotic use. And these people, the immigrants, have come from countries where they can get antibiotics over the counter, and so they're taking antibiotics for URIs, for the flu, for headaches, for all kinds of things. So we're trying to intervene on predisposing, reinforcing, and enabling factors to result in consciously looking at those three kinds of factors, and I'll explain those. Predisposing factors are knowledge, beliefs, what do you think, what do you know. We just asked a group of about 453 recently immigrated people from the Dominican Republic what caused colds, and about 7% of them said mal de ojo, which is evil eye. So when you're assessing how you're going to approach education, you've got to first of all say, what are the predisposing factors? What do these people know? What do they believe? What are their attitudes? What are the enabling factors? What can they do? With the healthcare professionals, we assume everybody knows how to do hand hygiene, but actually we've been learning lately that hand hygiene behavior is not necessarily taught, at least in our medical schools. I don't know, I'm sure it is here. Reinforcing factors such as organizational systems that reinforce the behavior, the organizational climate, and the culture to affirm behavior. So if nurses on a unit are trying to do hand hygiene, trying to do aseptic technique, etc., but there's no peer support, then there's a problem. So as we're thinking about systems change, we need to look at whether we need to look at enabling factors, reinforcing factors, or predisposing factors. We also need to look back to the Gen X, Gen Y, baby boomer thing, at new teaching methods for new generations. Blogs are used now. Podcasts are used. M-learning, moving from electronic learning on computers to mobile learning, wireless technology, and PDAs. So our nursing students now all record all of their patient encounters in their PDAs, and then we provide them at the end of their semester with a list of each of the techniques that they've learned, the kinds of nursing problems that their patients have had, et cetera, and it allows us also to analyze what kinds of skills and what kinds of learning interactions they're missing. So now let's move to the systems change, the systems level. And systems change has to occur at all levels as well. Structural, are things convenient, time-saving, and then philosophical and conceptual. Heightened institutional priorities, particularly among our leaders, and I think that we are seeing now a lot more attention on infection prevention as an important component of our care in our systems. Rewards and sanctions, accreditation, legislation, etc., and then the wonderful marketing campaign that you've had in the UK on Clean Your Hands. There's another similar campaign going on in Canada, in Ottawa. And now the WHO has just produced a wonderful guideline which is being field tested in ultimately 93 countries. Therefore, we really need a multifactorial approach to the system of care. Education, how, when, why, with specific emphasis on elective hygiene, not just, oh, my hands are dirty because I touch feces, but when should I be doing hand hygiene? Motivation, peer pressure, modeling, overt and continuing administrative support, cues to action. Didier Pathe is famous for that, his posters, etc. And then the patient and staff empowerment, and you probably have some of this as well, your partners in care idea, ask me if I've cleaned my hands, which is what is now on our badges in our hospital. All staff are required to wear a badge that says to the patient, ask me if I've cleaned my hands. This is a hospital-wide intervention that we did some years ago in Washington, D.C. to improve hand hygiene practices. It's published if you're interested, and I can certainly give you the reference. The idea was to change the organizational culture from the top down rather than having our clients be just the individual practitioners. Start with the board of directors and down. And what we did is we basically had leaders who were changing the culture and expectations, and our hypothesis was that normally the intervention is short-lived. So if you do an intervention, people might change their behavior for a day or two, and then it goes back to the way it was. Our hypothesis was that if we change the entire culture, it's going to take a long time, but over time, slowly, the hand hygiene will increase. So this is what we did. We had an intervention hospital and a comparison hospital. This is the number of hand washes that we recorded. The way we did the recording of hand washes was we had electronic counters in the dispensers, so we didn't have to use observers. We actually had counters in both hospitals. And this is what we found. The mean hand washes per patient care day, the lighter color is the study hospital, and the darker blue is the control hospital. The first two bars are at baseline, the mean hand washes per patient care day, and then the intervention period was when we're actually doing the intervention, and then the follow-up was 9 months later. And what you see is the frequency of hand hygiene basically didn't change that much. By 9 months, it had more than doubled in the intervention hospital. So it actually was consistent with our hypothesis that if you change the culture, it takes a long time, but it ultimately will be more effective and more sustained. So we also looked at rates of MRSA per 1,000 patient days. During baseline intervention, what you can see is there was no significant difference between the intervention and the control hospital, but by the follow-up time, there was a significant reduction in MRSA. And what we found is that the intervention hospital had a 33% decrease in the follow-up period in MRSA. The comparison hospital had a 31% increase, a highly statistically significant difference. Similarly, for VRE, you can see what happened. The intervention hospital, again, is in the lighter blue, and you can see that both hospitals during the follow-up period had reductions in VRE, but the intervention hospital had significantly more reduction. The intervention hospital had an 85% decrease. The control hospital had a 44% decrease, still significantly different. Now let's just end by talking about change at the societal level and a little bit about the principles of social marketing. We need to learn from the commercial sector. On American TV, the best TV is the commercials. It's really depressing. Now here, we've seen some wonderful shows. The other night we saw a show about Nureyev, and we saw a show about Croatia. In the U.S., you see Law and Order and, not too much educational stuff. The commercials are the best, most clever part, and we need to learn from the commercial sector. We need to be audience-centered, understand staff-perceived norms and perspectives, use strategic planning, and employ, along with other theory and tools, things such as social ecology, diffusion of innovation theory. We need to carefully design messages and because they can shift perceived social norms and raise awareness and knowledge. Professional journals, that's fine, and conferences, we're speaking to the choir, the popular media, and comprehensive campaigns, including media such as you've done here, rather successfully on the national level. I'm not so sure how it is on the individual level. But publicizing global health norms to national and local healthcare professionals can be very important. Now we're the WHO global hand hygiene guideline is significantly influencing practices in our country as well. So the lessons we can learn is that society's expectations of healthcare professionals can have an impact on practice. Hence, social marketing is useful, and community campaigns using mass media can work to help effect change in hospitals as well. When our public expects and watches for behavior, then that does have an impact on our behavior. All right. Now, we just had, through the Institute of Healthcare Improvement, a campaign called the 100,000 Lives Campaign, which was very successful. It was a national campaign to reduce certain kinds of infections. It was successful because there was explicit and overt support from the top down. The leaders in the hospital had to agree to sign on to these programs. So it wasn't just, the infection control professionals trying to get the leaders. It was the leaders signing on to this. People felt that they were part of a movement. They felt a sense of passion and belief. It was simple, clear, measurable actions and outcomes. And it addressed personal and organizational factors that are needed for change. So I think we need to change our approach. Our clients are no longer Nurse A, Dr. B. It's the organization and the system. And how do we get into the organization in effective ways? As Don Berwick says, systems thinking is not easy. Part of the reason is the need to deal with change at two different levels, the system of the work and the system of the management of the work. Now, this is the way I feel. I really can't go anywhere. My husband's here, actually. He's in the back, and he will attest to this. I can't not be on my email all the time. But the challenges for us, we need to think about and be a little bit more efficient and not so obsessive-compulsive. We need to focus on behavior. We need to expand beyond the hospital in our thinking. We need to look at outcomes research, and we need to have a global perspective. Now, the sociology of infection control is that the challenges are really not just technical and not just scientific. They're interpersonal and interprofessional. I want to end with two quotes. First one from Oliver Wendell Holmes, and he said that people differ less from century to century than we're apt to suppose. You will encounter the same opposition if you attack any prevailing opinion. Let not such experiences foster any love of dispute for its own sake. It is not often that an opinion worth expressing cannot take care of itself. And then the final quote from T.S. Eliot, "We shall not cease exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." So why do we do this? I have to show it. I'm a new grandmother, first one. And my husband and I were very lucky to be there at her birth. So that's Evelyn at 5 minutes and Evelyn at 4 months. This is why we do it, the next generation. Thank you very much.